From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a Detroit-area congressman's investment of campaign donations into crypto goes sideways.
Sanidar's campaign does not appear to be doing a lot of fundraising from individual donors. A lot of his money has come from himself and a group called the American Israel Public Affairs Committee.
Also, a new historical novel reimagines the Tudor queens in an adventure that recasts their time on the British throne.
What if she really was a witch? What if she had some sort of power and she used that for good? Not for evil, the way that they always said that witches did, but for good.
And our podcast On Hand heads up north during cherry season for the backstory on Michigan's most famous fruit crop.
The commercial cherry did not originate in the United States. It's definitely Asia or Eastern Europe. So the cherries were imported.
Those stories coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the jewel in Michigan's agricultural crown, how northern Michigan cherry crops came to dominate the pie pitch.
Of course, we have these beautiful rolling hills, especially in the northern part of the state. And so we always plant our orchards on the sides of those hills.
That's ahead today. But first, Congressman Sri Tanadar is facing a competitive re-election race in August's primary. A new story from the nonprofit newsroom The Intercept details some pretty unprecedented use of his campaign funds. Tanadar has a background in business. He's owned companies that performed lab work for the pharmaceutical and chemical industries. He has overcome bankruptcy filings and charges of animal mistreatment at his labs to be elected in 2020 in Michigan's 13th district, and he's represented much of Detroit ever since. But his campaign filings do look pretty eye-popping this time around. Akayla Lacey is a senior politics reporter at The Intercept, and she published over the weekend on this. Akayla, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me, April.
Can you maybe start by giving us a 10,000-foot view of how Sri Tanadar's fundraising looks for a congressman who's been in office for a couple of terms?
Yeah, so Tanadar has, if you look at his filings, he actually reported a negative number in contributions, which is extremely unusual for an incumbent Democrat. He has a little over $4 million cash on hand, but his campaign is also carrying more than $12 million in debt for loans that he's given himself over his last 5 years in Congress.
A lot of our listeners are familiar that AIPAC has been very active this campaign cycle in a number of key races in Michigan, including the open U.S. Senate race. So not a huge surprise that they might have had an interest in some House races, too. Now, we've known since 2024 that Sri Tanadar was investing over $3 million in cryptocurrency funds, thanks to reporting from the Detroit News. Akayla, I have to ask you, how is this even legal? Do you know, you cover races all over the country. Do you know of anybody else who's investing campaign donations in crypto?
I actually had the same question when I first saw this because it's not something that I've heard of before. But actually, there was reporting when Tanadar first invested these funds that he had seen other House Democrats doing the same thing and thought it might be a good idea. The reporting mentioned Adam Schiff, a Democrat from California, but it didn't specify whether he was talking about crypto funds. So I took away from that he was talking about investments in potentially other vehicles. I'm not sure if it was crypto. I haven't looked into Schiff's campaign, but it's something that I'm interested in looking further into. That was a response that we got from a lot of people who read this story. Is that even legal? It is legal. But as the expert who I spoke to said, while it's not unusual for campaigns to invest their funds in some sort of vehicle, hoping that they would grow, it is not the norm to invest them in a volatile industry like cryptocurrency. And this is while Tanadar has also been, has an A rating from the cryptocurrency industry. And while this is not, from my point of view, that isn't the biggest issue that his opponent is running on, but it is, one of the criticisms that has been raised about him.
You alluded to this when we were talking about the first question, but how has that investment worked out for him? What were you able to see in the filings about how his investments have performed?
So there were a few stories, maybe a year or in the last 2 years, about how he had actually performed well and reaped a large profit. I think it was a $1.7 million profit since the original investment in 2024. But as we know, crypto profits can get wiped out very quickly. And so he listed a loss of $634,000 in investment income loss from a mutual fund. In this mutual fund, it's called LPL Financial. He's listed in his previous campaign disclosures. They manage some of his assets. What I thought was more interesting, while the $630,000 was eye-catching, is that he also listed for this entire election cycle losses of $3.9 million, which it appears to be that would be from his crypto investments, because that would, he invested $3.7 million, so that would be more than the initial investment that he made. Again, it's not clear whether that is only crypto or it's other investments that he has with this company, but that is an eye-popping amount of losses for one election cycle.
Sure. Say more about Sri Tanadar's fundraising for this campaign cycle and the balance of large and small donors.
The bulk of Tanadar's fundraising comes from contributions that were $2,000 and over. There's, I would say, about a much smaller number between $1,000 and $2,000. And then, less than $20,000 came from contributors who gave under $200.
You mentioned before that he has, of course, he is known for having funded some of his own campaigns in the past. You're saying that he has done so again this time around?
Yes. So he actually gave himself another $650,000 last week per an FEC filing over the weekend. That is on top of what we included in the story, which is he gave himself $800,000 last June. And this is on top of, more than $11 million that he's given himself in previous cycles. But so as of Monday, he's given himself over $1.4 million this cycle alone.
Yeah. You mentioned, so we know that Sri Tanadar in the past has expressed to his constituents that he cares about, he cares about what's been going on in Gaza. This is a hot topic in Detroit, but it appears that he's done something of a 180, and the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee has been active in this campaign. Can you remind us how much they have given for this campaign cycle for Sri Tanadar's campaign?
So according to his latest filing for the last quarter, their donors have funneled about $270,000 to Tanadar's campaign, which for the last quarter accounted for 2/3 of all of the contributions that he cited.
And can you remind us a little bit about how Tanadar's voting record in the last session of Congress has looked in support for Israel?
Tanadar, again, was a target of AIPAC when he first ran in 2021-2022 cycle, but he reportedly, grew closer with the lobby after going on a trip to Israel in 2023 that was funded by AIPAC, and which he said, impacted his view on Israel policy. In his last election cycle, AIPAC spent more than $2 million against his primary opponent. So, people who were watching this race were anticipating that he might come in again this cycle, particularly given that his primary opponent this cycle is a much more outspoken critic of Israel and backed by, the progressive group Justice Democrats. He's a member of Democratic Socialist of America. Yeah.
Let's talk about Donovan McKinney. This is a guy who grew up in the northeast side of Detroit and has done work in environmental justice and several different kinds of legislative and public policy roles. Right now, he is serving in the Michigan State House of Representatives. Can you tell us a little bit about what he's had to say about Sri Tanadar's financial issues and difficulties lately?
So I actually haven't seen him respond to our reporting, but I am curious to see what they will say. But, a through line in his campaign has been criticizing Tanadar's proximity to the billionaire class. He's really running on what he says is bringing working class representation to Congress. He's, said that Tanadar bought his seat, referring to the amount of money that he's loaned himself. And he's also criticized him for using taxpayer money to fund campaign expenses.
Akela, like I mentioned, you cover and keep tabs on politics all over the United States. This is an election year where midterms we're expecting, some momentum for change candidates. But unseating an incumbent, especially one with money, is hard. What is your sense of what it would take for an incumbent in someone like Sri Tanadar's position to lose?
I've heard other strategists describe what we've seen already in the primaries where incumbents like Tanadar have lost as sort of the perfect storm, where you have voters who are still reeling from how Democrats treated Israel in the 2024 presidential cycle, coming off of seeing AIPAC having ousted two of the most vocal critics of Israel from Congress last cycle, and then this broader frustration with the party on issues from, ICE to money and, broader money in politics, not just the pro-Israel lobby, and this anti-incumbents or anti-establishment sentiment that we've seen from New York to Colorado. So all of those factors are on McKinney's side, but Tanadar has money on his side. And so a recent poll I saw showed Tanadar in a very close race with McKinney, not something that you would expect for, as we said, a three-term incumbent who, has ample financial resources on his side. I think Tanadar was up by just 4 points in this poll. And I haven't seen much other polling. But again, Tanadar has not appeared from the outside to be that concerned about this primary. I think that was kind of similar to what we saw with the dynamic with Representative Diana DeGette in Colorado, who sort of appeared to not begin taking the primary seriously until sort of the 11th hour and, was ousted by someone who was born the year after she was elected to Congress. So, I think a lot of the factors are on McKinney's side, but it's still, up in the air.
Akayla Lacey is a senior politics reporter at The Intercept. She also co-hosts the podcast The Intercept Briefing, which is excellent. Akayla, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, April. Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a break for a moment. After that, we get to know the Tudor queens. If all you know about the wives of Henry VIII is divorced, beheaded, died, you're in for a fun read with Gillian Lane's new historical fantasy. We'll meet her in just a minute. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Gillian Lane's new novel, Henry Tudor Must Die, is a fun fantasy take on Western Europe's most famous exes. When Henry VIII broke all the rules in pursuit of a male heir, he was doing things that monarchs have done for millennia. But something about his six charismatic queens has really stuck with us, from the pious Spaniard Catherine of Aragon to the irreverent English rose Anne Boleyn, all the way to Catherine Parr, who was one of the first female authors in the English language. Writer Gillian Lane is a queen in the north of Michigan, and she joins us now. Gillian, welcome to Stateside, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much. It's so good to be chatting with you.
What is it about this period and these women? I confess, they've always had a literary place in my heart, too. Like, there's been Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall series, the Broadway yes. musical Six. How was it that the Tudor queens came to occupy your headspace?
Well, I always joke that my parents took me on sort of an inappropriate vacation for like a 9-year-old. We went to England. We went to the Tower of London. We took all of these great historical tours. And that's where it started for me. I got sucked in. And, it took another 30-ish years before the book came to be. But I always just had this fascination with these women and this story and the fact that their lives were cut short. And so I kind of wanted to play puppet and see what happens if they don't have their lives cut short, and instead they go to get some revenge themselves.
It's a long path. Your book gets us up close and personal with just about all of the queens, especially the first two, Catherine of Aragon, who's referred to in the book as Lena, and mm-hmm. and Anne Boleyn. But we also yes. get tangential tales of Jane Seymour, Anne of Cleves, Catherine Howard, and Catherine Parr. Of the queens, do you have a favorite?
Oh, gosh. Yes, Anne Boleyn is sort of my favorite. She is the core of this story, the reason I started writing it, because there were these rumors that she was a witch after she died. One of those ways to discredit her because she hadn't produced a son and done what Henry wanted. And I thought, what if she really was a witch? What if she had some sort of power? And she used that for good, not for evil, the way that they always said that witches did, but for good. And so she was the spark of this story. And then the other piece of it was, so Catalina de Aragon, she was the first queen 24 years at Henry's side, poor thing.
Yeah.
And
she did her time. She did her time.
Seriously did. And I just always thought those two women, especially of all the wives, were pitted against each other. And I am of the mind that women should not be fighting women, especially when the man is the problem. But I just love the idea of having them, rather than be rivals, be allies, maybe even friends, working toward a common goal together and putting aside those differences that weren't even their differences, the differences that were pushed upon them by somebody else. So it was so much fun to have a relationship between them that felt strong and deep and loyal as the book goes on.
The story is woven around a sisterhood, a secret society that is pulling the strings behind European empires in this period. These women living in the Tudor age, they did have certain advantages as much as they were not in full control of their destinies. What was it about their stories and their history that you considered somewhat modern?
Pretty much every single one of the queens was an advocate for women's education. At that time, girls didn't go to school, especially if they weren't princesses of the realm. And so all of these women wanted the girls of England to get more education. They also advocated for the poor. This was at a time where the Reformation is happening, right? So Henry is dissolving the monasteries after his big fight with the Pope, and he's taking all this money, the money that used to go into the communities and help people that didn't have the funds, the ability to feed themselves, etc. And so they're trying to get money funneled back to the people rather than into Henry's pockets, because we know where it goes with Henry. It goes to war, it goes to women, it goes to jousting tournaments. Nonsense.
He's kind of the archetype of everything we think of as an excessive
yes.
monarch of his time.
Yes. And he was a smart man. He was educated. He was fashionable. He was supposed to be quite handsome when he was young. He was athletic. He had stuff going for him. But that's about all I can say that's nice about Henry. After that, he made a series of choices I don't like. So Henry Tudor must indeed die.
Right. Well, maybe this is a good point to hear a little bit of the story. Could I ask you to read a very dramatic scene in which Anne Boleyn, respect to your choice for her as a top queen, if not the top queen. I mean, she really had style. Amongst the queens. And this is the point at which Henry is getting rid of her in a very mortal sense. She's been sentenced to death.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we pick up right here. Anne is standing on the scaffold where the executioner is waiting. She has this whole audience of people that have turned out to see her die. They'd never seen a queen be beheaded before. Do they cheer? Do they boo? What do they do? Do they stay quiet? So Anne is standing there. She's got this escape plan. We're going to see if it works. But right now, she's waiting for the moment that she can cast her first curse. So here we go. "Do you have any final words, m'lady?" the priest asked, dragging Anne back to the moment. She blinked away the haze of her bloodlust, remembering that there were bigger things to accomplish today than revenge. So rather than scream curses at the sky, Anne just smiled. "God save the king from me." The priest frowned as though he could see the feral glint in her eyes, but didn't press her. "Very well," he said. "Then I shall lead a prayer for your..." Death seemed to stick on his tongue. "A prayer for your soul." When the priest stepped forward to address the crowd, Anne moved back, angling herself behind the executioner's broad frame, and slipped the bloodletting knife from the pockets of her petticoat. As the priest spoke of forgiveness and sin and the benevolence of their blessed king, Anne whispered words of her own, words that would indeed merit her death, at least by England's standards. She made a deep cut, a worthy sacrifice to access her power, across the palm of her left hand, and before the first drop of blood hit the wooden platform, Anne felt a sense of fading, like watching dye leach from a dress in the laundry waters. She looked down and found she could only faintly see her feet, her body, her arms. The invisibility curse was working. All eyes were still on the priest, and she had only moments now to spare. Heart galloping, Anne muttered the second spell under her breath. And then, with a blade that was steady from pure desperation, she sliced off the smallest finger of her left hand. And from there, we go on to see, will she escape? What happens with this blood magic that Anne has created? I will say this is only chapter 3, so no spoilers, and does continue throughout.
Yeah,
the book.
It would have been a very short book if her spells hadn't worked here. If
you're right? Yes.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Jillian Lane, Northern Michigan author of Henry Tudor Must Die, a rather fanciful retelling of the lives of the Tudor queens. I thought you did a really nice job striking the balance between the Tudor syntax and the way that these Tudor age women would have thought about their world and themselves and the modern syntax. I mean, you can't exactly put this in Shakespearean vernacular. I mean, you could.
Yes.
It would have been a very different book. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you think about that when you were working up how they would talk and how they would interact with each other?
It is a little bit modern. It's a little bit irreverent. It's a historical fantasy, really. There's a lot of historical fact in here, but I made a lot of it up. I let those queens live lives they couldn't have lived, take adventures they couldn't have done. And I think for me, I didn't want to get lost in old language or really old ways of thinking. There was a lot of religion that could have been in this book. And as a non-religious person, I didn't want to actually do that much research, I will admit. But also, I didn't want that to be the core of the story. There are a lot of books that do that really well. For this book, I wanted the core of the story to be the women and the sisterhood between them. This is a work of my imagination where we drop in and out of the Tudor world. So it's supposed to be fun. You're supposed to be able to connect to it, right? I think we can connect to it more when it feels a little more modern. And I wanted to connect to these queens.
I mean, it seems like that's one of the paths that you took to think of them as something more than footnotes in Henry VIII's Wikipedia bio. I mean, did you feel closer to them as people and how they would have thought from the research that you did complete for the book?
Oh, absolutely. And as I read more and more about these women, I always had just thought that they were not necessarily interchangeable. I knew that they had some distinct qualities, but that they didn't have that much going on when they were queens because they were just there with Henry. But they used that power that they had as queens often so wisely. Some of them did, you know, they got pretty dresses. They threw some parties, as you would once you had, you know, a crown, I would presume. But I was just so impressed by them and so sad that that's not part of the story that we tell. So it was a lovely treat for me to get to spend time with them and to learn more about them. And honestly, I could have written a book about each of them. And I want to go back and write more about them now.
You told us a little bit about your favorites among the queens. Are there those who sort of became your underdog favorites, like the ones that you hadn't thought were interesting based on what you knew of them, but who really came into relief for you?
Yeah. So both Anne of Cleves, or Anna von Cleve, as she would have been called in her native tongue, and Catherine Parr became very fascinating to me because they had shorter time spans. Anne of Cleves was only married to Henry for about 6 months because he didn't think she was pretty enough, which, coming from a man who at that point was twice her age and definitely had lost his looks, is quite rich, I will say.
Bro, seriously.
Yeah, exactly. Look in the mirror, Henry. but she was she got the best deal out of everybody. She got to have this annulment, basically, where she was able to have palaces and riches and really live her own life on her own terms. And then Catherine Parr is the final wife, and she is sort of thought of as the nursemaid, that she came in at the end of Henry's life to kind of shepherd him off into that good night. But she'd been married twice before, and she had survived some pretty difficult circumstances. And I started to think of her as this black widow. Like, you know, what happened to these men along the way? What is she doing with Henry now? Why would he pick her out of all the women in court? This woman who's been married, she was in her 30s or late 20s at that time, which in Tudor era was, I mean, ancient.
That's
and
crazy
so,
old to be married and becoming queen.
Crazy old.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I really grew fascinated by them.
There was another thing that I found myself returning to again and again in your story. And it is something that has been dealt through other historical novels, you know, with it, with a little bit more serious, with a little bit more serious tone. Why people put up with what Henry was doing. I mean, it was not a small thing to split England off from the Catholic Church. Obviously, it was about a little bit more than him getting remarried, but also kind of not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he just, there was this, certainly, you know, putting away, you know, putting aside wives and taking on new wives was not a new thing among monarchs of his era. But yeah, you really do get the sense that he was stirring the pot. Did you come away with a better feeling about what was gripping English society at that time, that people didn't just say, this, you know, this guy's being ridiculous, he's got to go?
Yeah. Well, I think there's sort of two pieces that led to Henry's unfettered power. The first was that England had just gone through a pretty tumultuous period. So they had the War of the Roses just a generation before. Henry's dad, Henry VII, was the first Tudor king, and they had just come out of this bloody conflict. And so Henry VIII is trying everything he can to make sure he's holding down power, right? He wants to get entrenched. He wants this to be a dynasty, which is why he's trying to get a son, even though women could become the ruler, the monarch of England at that time. But I think a lot of it was down to that sort of desperation, honestly, on the behalf of the Tudors. They were trying to make themselves important forever, which is gross, but what can you do? You know, that was their motivation.
It's what powerful people do.
It is. That you, once you get power, you want to hold on to power. So that's what they were doing. And I think the other piece of it was when the church split. So the Reformation is happening. There's sort of this Catholic Protestant thing happening in the background. And when the Church of England was formed, Henry made himself basically the supreme leader. He's the head of the Church of England, which means the order of power in the world goes God, Henry. So he has made himself this sort of all-powerful being on earth, right? He doesn't answer to anyone but God, not his priests, not his advisors, not his queens, not his children, not his people, heaven forbid, nobody. So he is basically the most powerful man besides the Pope in the world. Maybe he's up there with the Holy Roman Emperor. And that made it almost impossible for anybody to say, hey, Henry, like, maybe let's stop killing women. Or, hey, Henry, let's not go to war with France and lose again. So it was a fascinating time of such a power struggle and such a intense devotion to doing what was sometimes very wrong to keep that power.
Jillian, there's a line a little bit later in the book that really just kind of stopped me in my tracks. And Lena, Catherine of Aragon, as we have known and read of her, reflects, it was strange to think that many of the people she loved the most in the world hated each other. And yeah, that really brought home the complexities of what life at the court must have been like in those times.
Oh, absolutely. It was every man and woman for themselves, you know, Henry, and I should say, this was not just Henry. Many a monarch liked to behead even their closest advisors, their best friends, their relatives, their siblings, their wives. And you never knew where those alliances were shifting, what rumor would set off a whole new wave of paranoia, especially for Henry, who the moment you said, oh, so-and-so, it doesn't like you, he was like, oh, great, I'll just kill him and put his head on the Tower of London Bridge. Like, that's fine. I'll solve this problem. So it really was this delicate, dangerous dance. And I think that line refers especially to Anne Boleyn and Mary I, who goes on, you know, to be Bloody Mary. And Anne and Mary overlapped for just a couple of years. And Mary hated Anne Boleyn with every fiber of her being in real life. She thought she had taken her mom's place. Mary got demoted from a princess to a bastard overnight. And she refused to acknowledge her as queen, which sent her away from court. Her father was furious. Henry was like, don't talk to me until you acknowledge Anne as my queen and wife. And so honestly, props to Mary for standing up for what she believed in, for standing up for her mom. I'd do the same for my mom. And I think that obviously led to a lot of other problems later for Mary, which I'm exploring actually in book two of this series.
Wait, what? Yeah, there's going to be spoiler. A sequel. That's fantastic.
It follows right after Edward, so Henry's son, who only lived to be 15, has died. And if you know your Tudor history, there's a bit of a power struggle that emerges. Edward names a different successor, Lady Jane Grey. But Mary wants the throne. She's supposed to get it legally through Henry's will. And so a whole lot of drama breaks out in Tudor England yet again. It's a very tumultuous time for these Tudors. And so, yes, book two really explores the Mary and Elizabeth sibling rivalry and relationship. And what does it mean when your own flesh and blood, your sister, the person who's supposed to have your back and love you, might want you dead? So that's where we are right now. That's what I've been working on.
Gillian Lane's new book, Henry Tudor Must Die, is now available from a fine indie bookseller near you. She'll be at Horizon Books in Traverse City tomorrow and will appear at the National Writers Series on Wednesday night. Watch for more regional events on her Instagram profile. Gillian, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you. This was so much fun. I'll talk tutors anytime.
Hi, Michigander. When we come back, we're going to be telling the story of how the cherry became the iconic Michigan fruit.
We have what we call like sandy soils or light soils, and so cherries really don't like wet root.
By the way, we're still looking for a few of your favorite cherry picking adventures, your family traditions around the cherry orchard, or any other cherry related memories. You can drop us a voice memo to this email address, onhand@michiganpublic.org, or go to our website, michiganpublic.org, and find the On Hand page. There's a very easy to use form for sending us your story or your memory. Back in a moment, you're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. You may know that Michigan produces more tart cherries than any other state in the country, earning us the title of the Cherry Capital. Traverse City is at the center of all of this, home to the National Cherry Festival. But tart cherries are not actually native to Michigan. So how did they get here? And what keeps our state at the center of the cherry industry hundreds of years later? Today, we have the latest episode of our podcast On Hand, and we're going to take you on a journey all the way back to the first cherry tree in Michigan.
My name's Natalie Meadows. I'm from Whitmore Lake, Michigan, and I'm studying public health. How did Michigan become the cherry capital of the world? I just really like cherries, and I like the cherry ice cream, the cherry chocolate. I think Traverse City is a beautiful place, so I'm just very curious.
Okay, this is April Baer. I'm on site at the Ann Arbor Farmers Market, and I am looking for cherries. I'm going to a cookout today. It's 4th of July weekend, and I need some fruit. Hey guys, you got any fruit?
We have blueberries, but they're all sold out today.
Okay, thank you. Looking good. You guys got any fruit? You have any cherries?
No, we don't do fruit, unfortunately.
You seen any here?
I think the only ones I've seen were part of our fruit CSA.
Okay, we got raspberries, we got blueberries, all kinds of veggies here. Hey, you got any cherries today?
We've got a few left. Are you interested in them?
Yes, I'll clean you out. Whatever you got.
A small box or a large box?
Maybe a large one, okay. I think.
Let me get it for you.
Okay. Oh, look at those beauties. Robert, thank you so much.
Sure. You have a nice day.
You too.
Come July, cherries are everywhere here. Sweet, sour, deep maroon, golden yellow, and even blush pink. Michigan is the second largest grower of cherries in the nation, second only to Washington State, and the largest single producer of tart cherries. And we're home to the National Cherry Festival. But why? I'm April Baer, and this is On Hand, where we answer your questions about the things that make Michigan unique. And this week, we're telling the story of our favorite little stone fruit, the cherry. How did it get here? And how did Michigan become synonymous with cherries? Our producer, Michelle Jokish-Polo, went all the way to the birthplace of the Michigan cherry to figure out how we got here. Michelle, hi.
Hi, April.
So where did you go?
I went to the place in the state where for generations you've been able to find cherry farm after cherry farm lining the road, Old Mission Peninsula in Traverse City.
I think for the last 25 minutes it's been a lot of different farms where you can see these big trees, tall trees with cherries on them. First, I don't think I've ever seen a cherry tree, so I was...
Take your next ride onto Old Mission Road.
My final destination was Reverend Peter Doherty's house. He was a Presbyterian minister from the mid-1800s who came to live in Michigan as a missionary, and his job was to minister to and convert indigenous people in the area to Christianity. But he was a part of this local indigenous community, and local Ojibwe helped him build a cabin on what is now Old Mission Peninsula.
Oh, that part of Traverse City that separates the East and West Bays.
Yes, that's right. And it's believed that along with bringing his religion to the area, Reverend Doherty also planted the first cherry tree in Michigan. Even the website for the National Cherry Festival in Traverse City says Peter Doherty brought the first cherry tree here. So I had to go see it for myself.
Your destination is on the left.
Oh, there it is.
Hello, are you Chris?
I am. Michelle?
Yes.
So this is Peter's house?
Yeah, I'm Chris. This is Peter Doherty's house. Yeah.
Yeah, this is the house is built in 1842, and it was built with Peter Doherty and the local tribe's help.
This is Chris Reeser. He's president for the Peter Doherty Society.
Wow, a whole society for just one guy?
It's really more about the house and preserving a slice of northern Michigan history for generations to come.
But Michelle, what about the man? Was Reverend Peter like Michigan's Johnny Appleseed, but for cherries?
Well, that's the question that I asked Chris directly.
You know, there's this legend that Peter, Reverend Peter Doherty, was planted the first cherry tree here.
Yeah.
Is that true?
That's a good question. It certainly is an urban legend.
Wait a minute. You mean we're not even sure this is real?
Well, sit tight. There's more.
We have no written evidence that he actually planted any cherry trees. He might have. He was working on farms with the Native Americans. I'm sure they had fruit trees. The Native Americans had fruit trees before Peter Doherty got here. The difference between the European farming and the Native American farming is that Native Americans were farming for sustainability for themselves and not commercial farming. And what we were looking for as a nation was commercial farming. So it changed the way that the Native Americans farmed.
Do we know how cherries got to Michigan? Do you think they've always been here?
The commercial cherry did not originate in the United States. It originated, it's definitely Asia or Eastern Europe and not here. So the cherries were imported and then grown, and they happen to grow. This is a very good climate for growing cherries. Whether Peter Doherty did it or not is unclear. And maybe he brought a cherry pit and grew cherries, unclear. I think the legend grew because Peter Doherty's name here is really a special name. And people know that he had this mission and was here for approximately 10 years.
Hence, Old Mission Peninsula.
There were farmers that moved in. And so the farmers planted cherry trees, they planted apple trees, they planted other crops. The fruit crops, the stone fruit crops, were something they could export to other states.
And those farms on Old Mission Peninsula and that fruit crop, including cherries, was easily accessible for export.
Steamers would come in here to the harbor. They would fill up with fresh fruit, and those would be taken to Chicago, Detroit, Milwaukee, and other cities. And when the weather was cold, what they did after the fruit crop was done is they dried them and then packaged barrels of fruit, or they canned them.
The truth is that we don't really know who exactly brought cherries to Michigan. Because Reverend Peter Doherty is associated with Old Mission Point in Traverse City, and Traverse City is synonymous with cherries, he's come to be the person we believe is responsible for planting the first cherry in the state. I did want to say that I found some research that showed that other missionaries moved through the area around the same time as Reverend Doherty and documented their purchase of cherry trees and the farmer to spread the cherry trend far and wide in the early 20th century was D.H. Day, whose name you know from the Sleeping Bear National Lakeshore. What's for certain is cherries became a hit among farmers in the Traverse City area in the mid-1800s, and since then, they never look back.
Okay, well, thank you for looking into the cherry tree's origins for us.
You're welcome.
Michigan produces more tart cherries than any other state in the country, earning it the title of Cherry Capital of the World.
On Grand Traverse Bay, an arm of Lake Michigan, lies Traverse City, the cherry capital of the world.
But how did this happen? And why here? And what is it that keeps Michigan at the center of the cherry industry? Nikki Rothwell is 2025's Cherry Industry Person of the Year. She coordinates the Northwest Michigan Horticulture Research Center and is a Michigan State University Extension Specialist in tree fruit integrated pest management. Okay, question number one, sour or sweet? What's your favorite?
Oh, man, for sure. Sour cherries are the best. There is nothing better than tart cherries that you scoop right out of the tank. So we harvest cherries into tanks of cold water, and then they go to a cooling pad where they get flushed with cool water. And you scoop those guys, those beautiful red fruits out of that tank, and they're tart, but they're sweet, and they're just such, you feel like you have arrived.
That is what I'm talking about.
Today, this region is the proud bearer of over 1 million cherry trees, making it necessary to import thousands of laborers to harvest and process the crops.
Now, when people hear Michigan cherries, a lot of us have just kind of grown up with this understanding that we are the cherry state. Can you tell us a little bit about why cherries thrive here in the first place?
On the growing side, we have the trifecta that really makes cherries grow well here. First, we have what we call like sandy soils or light soils. And so cherries really don't like wet roots. They're susceptible to Phytophthora, which is a disease that really forms when you have heavier soils. So cherries don't like wet feet, is what we always say. So lighter soils is good. And then, of course, we have these beautiful rolling hills, especially in the northern part of the state. And so we always plant our orchards on the sides of those hills. So if we do have some bad luck where there's cold weather that comes in, basically that cold weather or that cold air, just like water, goes to the lowest spot in the orchard. So those rolling hills, the sandy soils, and then, of course, you know, the crowning jewel of our state, all of our lakes. But in our case, Lake Michigan plays the biggest role just because that moderates the temperature, especially in the springtime. So the lake's really cold. And when those prevailing winds come in from the west, that cold water keeps our orchards nice and tight in, you know, dormant, and then they slowly come out of dormancy, and then hopefully we have a great crop.
Now, we know that Northern Michigan produces millions of pounds of cherries annually. Can you say more about, like, where the Traverse City area lies in our weather pattern that makes all that possible?
So back in the day, in the 1800s, turn of the century, I feel like our weather patterns were much more consistent. And so, you know, we'd have a crop annually every year. Today, I'm just like, we're all in the office frantically. Is the rain coming? Is it not coming? Is it coming? Is it not coming? And we're getting these periods of extended droughty conditions. And so we're seeing a lot of changes in like how we use water. And in the past, we didn't have to irrigate tart cherries because we had beautiful rain patterns that the rain came when you wanted. The other thing, when the rain comes today, I feel like it doesn't come in these nice, gentle, you know, 1-inch rains. It comes 3 inches at a time and it comes fast. And so, you know, the water, you know, it just can't, our soils can't contain that or grab that water fast enough, so we have a lot of runoff. So there's a lot of changes, I feel like, to climate that maybe when we set ourselves up to grow cherries for here for the, you know, eternity, I think Mother Nature is kind of throwing a wrench into that. And as researchers, we're trying to help growers, you know, adapt to those changes and take some of that risk out of growing what used to be, you know, our stock and staple here in Northern Michigan.
Nikki Rothwell of the Northwest Michigan Horticulture Research Center and also with Michigan State University's Agricultural Extension. Nikki, thank you so much.
Oh, well, it was so fun to be here. I love your show and this is a real honor for me. So thanks so much.
It starts with the soil and the lake. Together, they create the conditions that have made Michigan synonymous with cherries. More than 70% of the nation's cherry crop is grown here. But before those cherries make their way into pies and jams and grocery stores all across the country, they pass through the hands of farmers who spend their lives tending the land. The Eckerly family farms more than 400 acres across Sutton's Bay and Leelanau County. Their orchards hold more than 20,000 trees, mostly cherries, but also peaches and apples. It is work that you measure in seasons and generations. Jim Eckerly is a third-generation farmer from Traverse City. Growing up, he always imagined he'd follow his father into agriculture, but dairy farming was another story.
Dad farmed, and he milked cows, and I hated that, so we went to cherry farming. I knew right away I was going to be a cherry farmer. When I bought the farm, they took this farm here as a neighbor. They told me that they wasn't going to help me. They didn't want me farming. And I was too stubborn.
That stubbornness has carried him through decades of change. The orchards may look the same from a distance, but the way cherries are harvested has transformed dramatically.
It used to be a shaker and a rollout went underneath the tree and you shook cherries, rolled it up and put it into a conveyor, put it into a tank. Then it went to a, what they call a shockwave. It's an upside down umbrella that opens up. You go up to the tree and the umbrella comes out upside down and puts the cherries and you go down the conveyor and into the tank.
Each season, the Eckerly farm harvests more than 1 million cherries. What once took long hours and multiple steps can now be done with pretty remarkable speed. The technology has changed, but that basic rhythm remains the same. Trees, fruit, harvest, repeat.
We figure we get a growing season, then we got the harvest season. And I always say when we start harvesting, I don't care anything about the crop. Just as long as everybody's healthy. All the people that work for me, I hope they're still healthy when they're done.
In recent years, another change has arrived. Jim's grandson, Zach, has joined the family operation.
You got to remember with this that you, like he knows, you got to plan ahead for planting and then what, 7-8 years before you might even shake a cherry. So an old orchard's ready to come out. You got to kind of have a plan for the next, because if all your trees are old and then you take everything out and plant it all at once and you have nothing left, you got to kind of every year take a little bit out, plant new.
And for both of them, farming is more than a livelihood. It's a commitment to a place and family.
I think patience is the biggest one. Especially during the harvest time, you gotta have some patience. And gotta have your head on your shoulders and be aware.
And they hope people understand that the cherries that appear on a kitchen table have traveled a long road to get there.
You see a tractor going up and down the road. Just have some patience with him because he's giving you something to eat.
Yeah.
Working for a way to give you something to eat.
Thank you to Jim, Zach, and all the cherry growers in our state that give us one of Michigan's truly delightful treats every year. They're part of the reason our state is synonymous with this small but mighty stone fruit. And to our listener, Beth, thank you for asking this very important question. What's your question about Michigan? This podcast is here solely to get answers to the things you want to know about our state. Any person, place, or thing that makes us quirky and different. Send us your question and we might just investigate it in a future episode of On Hand. You can send questions in an email or voice memo to onhand@michiganpublic.org. That's onhand@michiganpublic.org. Today's episode was produced by Michelle Jokish-Polo. Other producers are Mike Blank, Ronia Cabansug, and April Van Buren. Our senior producer is Mercedes Mejia, and our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Digital services by Jody Westrick. Music for this pod came from Blue Dot Sessions and from Audio Network. Thanks for listening. Coming at you from the land of hope and dreams. That's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.